Podcastle, episode 516D, for April 5th, 2018. Podcastle's 10th anniversary special, The Best of Podcastle, number 2. Makeisha in Time, by Rachel K. Jones. Rated R.
Salam, good people, and welcome to our 10th anniversary special. This is Khalida Muhammad Ali, your host and co-editor over here at Podcastle. I'm very proud and honored to host the second most favorite story as voted by our listeners. And I have to admit, when I learned that this one was voted as a favorite, I pulled out my katana and dared anyone to try to stop me from hosting this episode. Besides being one of my favorite stories of all time, it's written by one of my favorite people of all time. Podcastle is very proud to present Makeisha in Time, written by Rachel K. Jones. Rachel K. Jones grew up in various cities across Europe and North America, picked up and mostly forgot 6 languages, and acquired several degrees in the arts and sciences. Now she writes speculative fiction in Portland, Oregon. Contrary to rumors, she is probably not a secret android. Rachel is a Ward Fantasy Award nominee, Tiptree Award honoree, and winner of Writers of the Future. Her fiction has appeared in dozens of venues worldwide, including Lightspeed, Beneath Ceaseless Skies, Strange Horizons, and all 4 Escape Artists podcasts. Follow her on Twitter, at Rachel K. Jones. Your narrator this week is Kay Tempest Bradford. Kay Tempest Bradford is a speculative fiction writer by night, a media critic and writing instructor by day, and a podcaster in the interstices. Her short fiction has appeared in multiple anthologies and magazines, including Strange Horizons, Electric Philosophied, Diverse Energies, In the Shadow of the Towers, and many more. She's the host of Originality, a podcast about the roots of creative genius, and contributes to several more. Her media criticism and reviews can be found on NPR, IO9, and in books about Time Lords. When not writing, she teaches classes on writing and inclusive fiction through Lit Reactor and writingtheother.com. Visit her blog at ktempestbradford.com and her Patreon at patreon.com/ktempestbradford. Pack your first aid kit with some anti-venom, your good sneakers, some sunscreen, a Swiss Army knife, and perhaps a windbreaker, because it's going to be a bumpy and dangerous ride.
Makeisha in Time by Rachel K. Jones. Makeisha has always been able to bend the fourth dimension, though no one believes her. She has been a soldier, a sheriff, a pilot, a prophet, a poet, a ninja, a nun, a conductor of trains and symphonies, a cord wiener, a comedian, a carpetbagger, a troubadour, a queen, and a receptionist. She has shot arrows, guns, and cannons. She speaks an extinct Ethiopian dialect with a perfect accent. She knows a recipe for mead that is measured in Aurochs horns, and with a katana she is deadly. Her jumps happen intermittently. She will be yanked from the present without warning, and live a whole lifetime in the past. When she dies, she returns right back to where she left, restored to a younger age. It usually happens when she is deep in conversation with her boss, or arguing with her mother-in-law, or during a book club meeting just when it is her turn to speak. One moment, Makeisha is firmly grounded in the timeline of her birth, and the next, she is elsewhere, elsewhen. Makeisha has seen the sun rise over prehistoric shores, where the ocean writhed with soft, slimy things that bore the promise of dung beetles, Archaeopteryx, and Edgar Allan Poe. She has seen the sun set upon long-forgotten empires. When Makeisha skims the map of the continents, she sees a fractured Pangaea. She never knows where she will jump next or how long she will stay, but she is never afraid. Makisha has been doing this all her life. Makisha learned long ago to lie about the jumping. When she was 9, she attempted to prove it to her mother by singing in Egyptian, but her mother just laughed and sent her to do the dishes. She received worse when she contradicted her history teachers. It was intolerable, sitting in school, the body of a child but with the memories of innumerable lifetimes, while incomplete truths and half-truths and outright lies were written on the board. The adults called a conference about her attention-seeking behavior, and she learned to keep her mouth shut. The hardest part is coming back. Once, when she was 12, she was slouched in the pew at church when she felt the past tug. Makisha found herself floundering on the roiling ocean of the Mediterranean, only to be saved by Moorish pirates who hauled her aboard in the nick of time. At first, the bewildered men and women treasured their catch as a mascot and a good luck charm. Later, after nearly 10 years of fine sea craft and fearless warfare, they made her captain of the ship. Makisha took to piracy like sheet music. She could climb ropes and hold her grog with the best sailors, and even after losing an eye in a gunpowder explosion, she never once wept and wished herself home. The day came when, at the Pasha's command, she set sail to intercept Spanish invaders in Ottoman waters. It was a hot night when they sighted the lanterns of the enemy shuddering on the waves. Makisha's crew pulled their ship astern the enemy's vessel in the dark and the fog after midnight. She gave the order, "Charge!" her deep voice booming through the mists, echoed by the shouts of her pirates as they swung on ropes over the sliver of ocean between the ships. And suddenly, an explosion and a pinching sensation in her midriff, and she was 12 again, in a church pew, staring at her soft palms through 2 perfect eyes. That was when she finally wept, so loud and hard that the reverend stopped his sermon to scold her. Her father grounded her for a week after that. People often get angry with Makisha when she returns. She can't control her befuddlement, the way the room spins like she is drunk, and how for days and weeks afterwards she cannot settle back into who she was. Because the truth is, she isn't the same. Each time she returns from the past, she carries another lifetime nestled within her like the shell of a Matryoshka doll. Once, after the fall of the Roman Empire, she joined a peasant uprising in Bavaria. Charging quickly from fiefdom to fiefdom, their band pushed back the warlords to the foothills of the Alps. Those who survived sued for mercy, begged her not to raise their fields, pledged fealty to her. As a condition of the peace, Makisha demanded their daughters in marriage to seal the political alliance. The little kings, too afraid of the barbarian queen to shout their umbrage, conceded. They even attended the weddings, where Makisha stood with her sword peace tied at her waist and took the trembling hand of each Bavarian princess into her own. Once the wedding guests left, Makisha gathered her wives together in the throne room. "Please," she said to them, "help me. I need good women I can trust to run this kingdom right." With their help, she established a stable state in those war-torn days. In time, all her wives made excellent deputies, ambassadors, sheriffs, and knights in her court. Makisha had been especially broken up when her time in Bavaria was cut short by a bout of pneumonia. Many of her wives had grown to be dear friends of hers, and she wondered for months and months what had become of them and their children, and whether her fiefdom had lasted beyond her passing. She wanted to talk to her best friend Philippa, to cry about it, but her calls went unanswered and so did her emails. Makisha could not remember the last time she had spent time with Philippa or her other friends here in the present. It was so hard to remember when her weeks and months were interspersed with whole lifetimes of friends and lovers and enemies. The present was a stop-motion film, a book interrupted mid-page and abandoned for years at a time. And when she did return, she always carried with her another death. Makisha does not fear death anymore. She has died so many times, always awakening in the present, whole and alive as before the jump. She does not know what would happen if she died in the present. Perhaps she would awaken in the future. She has never tried to find out. She cannot remember her first death. She probably died hundreds of times in her infancy, before she was old enough to walk. Her jumps left her in the wilderness or ocean more often than not, and when she did arrive near civilization, few took pity on a strange, abandoned child who could not explain her presence. Makisha's mother often joked about her appetite, how from the time she was a baby, she ate like a person on the verge of starvation. Her mother does not know how close this is to the truth. These days, Makisha wears her extra pounds with pride, knowing how often they've been her salvation. When Philippa finally returns her calls, she reams Makisha for slighting her all year, for the forgotten birthday, for the missed housewarming party. Makisha apologizes like she always does. They meet up in person for a catch-up over coffee, and Makisha resolves that this time she will be present for her friend. They are deep in conversation when she feels the tug, just as Philippa is admitting that she's afraid of what the future may bring. "Ugh, no," thinks Makisha when she finds herself blinking on the edge of a sluggish river under the midday sun. Two white bulls have lifted their heads to stare at her, water dripping from their jowls. Makisha struggles to keep the conversation fresh in her head as she casts around for a quick way home. She chooses the river. It is hard that first time to make herself inhale, to still her windmilling arms, to let death take this Matryoshka life, so she can hasten back to the present. She has lost the thread of the conversation anyway when she snaps back to Philippa's kitchen. "Migraine," she explains, rubbing away the memory of pain from her dizzy head, and Philippa feeds her 2 aspirin and some hot mint tea. Makisha resolves to do better next time, and eventually she does. On her first date with Carl, she strangles herself with strings from the lute of a Hittite bard. On their wedding day, she detours to a vast desert that she cannot place, which she escapes by crawling into a scorpion nest. That death was painful. The next time she jumps, 2 days later, on their honeymoon, she takes the time to learn the proper way to open her wrists with a sharp-edged rock. Her husband believes her when she says it's migraines. All of it. The self-imposed silence, the suicides, the banishing of her fantastic past to the basement of her brain, these are the price of a normal life, of friendships, and a marriage, and a steady job. Mundane though it is, Makisha reminds herself that this life is different from the other ones. Irreplaceable. Real. Still, she misses the past where she has lived most of her life. She reads history books with a black marker and strikes out the bits that make her scoff. Then, with a red pen, she writes in the margins all the names she can recall, all the forgotten people who matter just as much as George Washington and Louis XIV. When Carl asks, she explains how the world has always belonged to more than just the great men who were kings and presidents and generals, but for some reason no one wrote it down. "I think you're trying too hard," he says. And she hates the pity in his eyes when he holds up his hands and adds, "But if it makes you happy, keep on with it." One day, as a surprise, her husband drove her 4 hours to a museum hosting an exhibit on medieval history. Makisha screeched and grabbed Carl's arm when she saw the posters at the entrance. 8th century Bavaria. It had been 5 years and dozens of self-murdered lives since she was torn from her thriving kingdom, from her deputy wives and her war band, but the memories were still so fresh. Her face was composed as she purchased the tickets, but she bounced on the balls of her feet all the way to the front of the line. It was the first time she had encountered any proof of a previous life. Euphoria flared in her breast when she peered into glass cases that held familiar objects, old and worn, but recognizable all the same, the proof of her long years of warfare and wisdom and canny leadership. A lead comb, most of its bristles missing, its colored enamel long ago worn to gray. It had belonged to Juti, perhaps. She had such fine long hair, although she had kept it bound tightly for her work as a doctor. A thin gold ring she had given to dark-eyed Berthe in commemoration of her knighthood. And best of all, a silver coin stamped with her own stylized profile, her broad nose jutting past her Bavarian war helm. There was a placard on the glass. Makisha read it thrice, each time a little slower, thinking perhaps she'd missed something. But no. Early medieval objects from the court of a foreign king. He reigned in Bavaria for about 30 years. He? Makisha stormed back to the entrance, demanded to speak with the manager, her vision swimming a violent red, her hand groping for a pommel she did not wear anymore. It was wrong. It was all wrong, wrong, wrong. Her wives, assigned a husband and stripped of their deputyship? Their legacy handled to a manufactured person? Carl begged her to tell him what was wrong. Makisha realized she was shouting oaths in ancient German, and that was when she felt the familiar tug in her navel and found herself spinning back, back, further back than she had gone last time, until she arrived on an empty beach beneath a moon with a smooth, craterless face. Her practiced eye spotted three ways to die on its first sweep: drowning, impaling, crushing. But there was Juti's comb to consider, and that placard. When she gave up time travel, she never thought she had surrendered her legacy, too. Makisha turned her back on the ocean and walked into the woods, busying herself with building a fire and assembling the tools she would need for her stay, however long it might be. She had learned to be resourceful and unafraid of the unfamiliar creaks and groans in the ferny green of the prehistoric underbrush. She chipped a cascade of sparks into her kindling, and that is when Makisha formed her plan. She is done with the present, with the endless self-murder, and with the repression and suffocation and low stakes. A woman unafraid to die can do anything she wants. A woman who can endure starvation and pain and deprivation can be her own boss, set her own agenda. The one thing she cannot do is to make them remember she did it. Makisha is going to change that. No more suicides then. Makisha embraces the jumps again. She is a boulder thrown into the waters of time. In 8th century Norway, she joins a band of Viking women. They are callous but good-humored, and they take her rage in stride as though she has nothing to explain. They give her a sword taller than she is, but she learns to swing it anyway, and to sing loudly into the wind when one of the slain is buried with her hoard, sword folded on her breast. When she returns to the present, Makisha has work to do. She will stop mid-sentence, spin on her heel, and head for the books, leaving an astonished co-worker or friend or her husband calling after her. She pours everything into the search for her own past. One of her contacts sends her an email about a Moorish pirate, a woman making a name for herself among the Ottomans. A Spanish monk wrote about her last voyage, the way she leapt upon her prey like a gale in the night, how her battle cry chilled the blood. Makisha's grin holds until the part where the monk called her a whore. This is accepted, without question, as factual by the man writing the book. She is obsessed. Makisha almost loses her job because of her frequent forgetfulness, her accidental rudeness. Her desk is drowned in ancient maps. Her purse is crammed with reams of genealogies. In her living room, which has been lined from wall to wall with history books ever since Carl moved out, Makisha tries to count the lives stacked inside her. There are so many of them. They're crowding to get out. She once tried to calculate how many years she had been alive. It was more than 1,000. And what did they amount to? Makisha is smeared across the timeline, but no one ever gets her quite right. Those who found the cairn of her Viking band assumed the swords and armor meant the graves of men. A folio of her sonnets, anonymous after much copying, are attributed to her assistant, Giorgio. "You're building a fake identity," Philippa tells her one day, daring the towers of books and dried-out markers to bring Makisha some soup. "There weren't any black women in ancient Athens. There weren't any in China. You need to come to grips with reality, my friend." "There were two," says Makisha, fiercely, proudly. "I know there were. They were just erased, forgotten. I'm sure there were a few exceptions, but women just didn't do the kind of things you're interested in." Makisha says, "It doesn't matter what I do, if people refuse to believe it." Her jumps are more subdued after that. She turns to the written word for immortality. Makisha leaves love poetry on the walls of Aztec tombs in carefully colored Nahuatl pictograms. She presses cuneiform into soft clay, documenting the exploits of the proud women whose names are written in red in the margins of her history books. She records the names of her lovers in careful Hanzi strokes with horsehair bristles in bamboo books. Even these, the records she makes herself, do not survive intact. Sometimes the names are replaced by others deemed more remarkable, more credible, by the scribes who come after. Sometimes they are erased entirely. Mostly the books just fade into dust with time. She takes comfort knowing that she's not unique, that the chorus of lost voices is thundering. She is fading from the present. She forgets to eat between jumps, loses weight. Sometimes she starves to death when she lands in an isolated spot. Carl catches her one day at the mailbox. "Sorry for just showing up. You haven't returned my calls," he explains, offering her a sheaf of papers. Makisha accepts them and examines the red-stamped first page of their divorce papers. "You need to sign here," Carl says, pointing upside down at the bottom of the sheet. "Also on the next page." "Please?" That last word carries a pleading tone. Makisha notes his puffy eyes and a single white hair standing out on the black nest of his beard. "How long has it been?" she asks. She has lived at least 3 lifetimes since he left, but she isn't sure. "Too long," he says. "Please, I just need your signature so we can move on." She pats her pockets and finds a red pen. Makisha wonders how many decades or centuries until this signature is also altered or lost or purposely erased, but she touches pen to paper anyway. Halfway through her signature, she spends 26 years sleeping under the stars with the Aborigines, and when she comes back, the rest of her name trails aimlessly down the sheet. Carl doesn't seem to notice. After he leaves, she escapes into India for a lifetime, where she ponders whether her time travel is a punishment or purgatory. When she returns to the present again, Makisha weeps like she did when she was 12 and her heart was breaking for her days as a pirate. Perhaps it is not the past that is yanking her away. Perhaps the present is crowding her out. And perhaps she has finally come to agree with the sentiment. In her living room, among the towers of blacked-out books, Makisha sees 6 ways to die from where she stands. Perhaps the way out is forward. Break through the last Matryoshka shell like a hatchling into daylight. But no. No. The self-murders were never for herself, not once. Makisha is resilient. She is resourceful. And she has been bending the fourth dimension all her life, whether anyone recognizes it or not. A woman who has been pushed her whole life will eventually learn to push back. Makisha reaches forward into the air. With skillful fingers that have killed and healed and mastered the cello, she pulls the future toward her. She has not returned.
This story, I feel, was written for every woman whose voice was loud and yet still unheard, whose genius went unrecognized or was stolen, whose might was shamed, whose quiet perseverance was mistaken for weakness instead of mercy. This story, I believe, is for me and the little girls my daughters once were, and little girls now and yet to come. I could listen to this story again and again. Today, I'll leave you with a quote that I believe originated from the Martin Show that ran in the 90s. You go, girl. Peace.